Good evening. Welcome to Writers at Work, and I'm very glad that you can hear me. I'm sorry that we all look so strange behind these microphones, but you wouldn't like us very much if you couldn't hear us. My name is Maureen Freely, and I'm here this evening to introduce two very gifted writers, Alan Wall and Sheena Mackay. I'll begin by telling you a bit about Sheena Mackay, although I'm sure I don't have to. She was born in Edinburgh in 1944. Left school at 16 when she won a poetry competition, the Daily Mirror, and published her first book in 1964. So she was 20 years old at the time, but she'd actually written the two novellas when she was a teenager. And I've been trying to count her, trying to figure out six novels.
Eight
novels. Yeah. And almost as many collections of short stories, would you say?
Four.
And the one of the problems that critics have is this: can you hear me, or do I just look very strange? Right. One of the problems that critics have is they can't quite decide what sort of book Sheena writes, because she won't write one sort of book. She's she can be a wonderful satirical writer, and she can write elegiacally at other times, and sometimes in one book both. One critic has praised her for her sardonic views of the British class system at work, or more often, in social climbing chaos. Alan Wall was born in Yorkshire and educated at Oxford, and he's going to be reading tonight from two novels that have come out recently, both to high acclaim. The most recent is China, which is about an artist and his patron father, also patronizing father. And it was praised by The Guardian as being dense, poetic, and exhilarating, intensely readable. And he'll also be reading from The School of Night, which is a scholarly mystery thriller, a quest to identify the real Shakespeare. And he's accumulated the most amazing collection of quotes for this book. Anne Stephenson, the poet, said, after reading The School of Night, I don't think there's a better British prose writer living. And the quote that I actually envy more is a reader on the website who said, it's amazing that a book as light as this can hold so much. I think Alan will be reading first, and then Sheena will be reading, and then we'll be discussing various things amongst ourselves, if you can bear to hear us behind these contraptions, and then we'll be opening to the house. But at the moment, I'd like to welcome Alan Wall.
Thanks very much. I wrote The School of Night. Can you hear me through this? I've warned, I have to get to a certain distance from this microphone. Can you hear me like that? I've been asked many times why I wrote The School of Night. Is that all right? And the truth is, I wanted to write a book about the Shakespeare authorship question, because it began to intrigue me for all sorts of reasons. I wasn't quite sure why so many people became so obsessed by it, since I personally was happy to assume that the works of William Shakespeare had been written by William Shakespeare, but obviously a lot of other people felt differently. As I started looking at it, this strange cabal of human beings called the School of Night came to my attention. It was basically a group, or if it existed at all, it's thought to be a group centered around Walter Raleigh in his heyday, who gathered around him scientists, astronomers, all sorts of people who were simultaneously brilliant and represented something of a dangerous group in terms of the politics and power play of the day. And the more I read about them, the more intrigued I became. And I realized also that the authorship question many of the people put forward as possible alternative writers of the works of Shakespeare were centered around this group. So this passage I'd like to read explains in a way how Sean, who's the main character in my novel, ends up utterly obsessed by pursuing the subject of The School of Night. Now at long last I had come to study in detail and without prejudice the darkest of all the rumours that have emanated from the school of night, the one that might at last make sense of the crowding doubts that had been accruing in my mind through the years. Many accepted that Marlowe's hand could not be disentangled from Shakespeare's in the early works. Even the most orthodox of Stratfordians, including Sidney Lee, who had effectively invented the modern orthodoxy of the bard, were in agreement that the following plays could not be settled between the young actor from Stratford and the young scholar from Canterbury. Titus Andronicus, Richard II, Richard III, and the three parts of Henry VI. That's a fair bit of the corpus to be another body underneath the accepted body. In fact, there's no doubt that if Marlowe could ever have been viewed as a serious candidate for the true authorship of the works attributed to Shakespeare, that case would have represented the gravest threat ever posed to the Stratfordians. But they have always had one simple and seemingly unanswerable response to this lethal enquiry. Marlowe had died on the 30th of May, 1593. But had he? I studied the evidence in detail. I went down 20 or 30 times to Deptford Strand and St. Nicholas, as though proximity to the reported events might somehow let the truth leach into me out of the ground, out of the air. I became convinced, though I couldn't prove it, that this stretch of the river had provided these lines in Hamlet. And duller shouldst thou be than the fat weed that rots itself in ease on Lethe Wharf, wouldst thou not stir in this. I became more and more convinced that Marlowe had not, in fact, died that night in Deptford in the house of Mrs. Bull, that instead his friend and patron, Thomas Walsingham, had arranged for a drunken sailor of his height and build to be killed with a poniard through the eye and to be dressed in Kit's clothes. A local inquest had been fixed and swiftly conducted. Promises had been made, money had changed hands. Strangely, no friend or relative of Marlowe's had been summoned to identify the body, and where the corpse was buried had remained a mystery to this day. Nearby, says the plaque, hardly even taking the trouble to believe its own words. This way, Marlowe did not have to return to Star Chamber, and so did not have to talk of what had happened in the School of Night. He was spared the ordeal of incriminating all his friends under torture. He was spared, and so, of course, were they. All three men in the room with him when he died were in the employment of Thomas Walsingham, and all three were taken back into that employment without question after they were released from their perfunctory imprisonment 1 month later. Marlowe was undoubtedly Walsingham's favourite. It was at Walsingham's house that he mostly stayed. Some have even said that their relationship went far beyond mere friendship. It would have been a curious act to have taken Marlowe's murderers back into his employment so swiftly, so entirely without recrimination. So if Marlowe didn't die, then what did he do? He was spirited abroad, under a false name, in some chartered vessel covered by the Kentish mist. He went to live in the north of Italy, there to continue writing plays for the rest of his life. Plays of mystery and devastation, plays about murder and disguise, about how a human being is an exile even from himself. Plays endlessly concerned, obsessively and inexplicably concerned with people who die but are not really dead, who come back after 10 or 20 or 30 years to be met with tearful incredulity by those who thought they'd witnessed their demise. But there was a problem. If these astounding works were to be published, under whose name could that be done? Well, who better than another low-born theatrical character with gifts above his station, though nothing like Kit's? Born in the same year, his father another leather worker, and with whom Kit had already collaborated, using the actor for his working theatrical knowledge while he provided all the intellectual substance. Who better than a man from Stratford desperate for coin, who knew his way around the London stage? They had something on him in any case, for one of Kit's discoveries in his murky work at Reims was that Shakespeare was not merely Catholic, but had done some business for the cause during his hidden years amongst the recusants of Lancashire. This he very much wished to keep secret. Thus did these inexplicable works of loss and desperation come to be published under the name of the reasonably gifted actor from Stratford-upon-Avon, whose first published work appeared a few months after Kit's own disappearance from the world. Thus did Marlowe, the divinity student and translator of Ovid, provide all the material which could not have been provided by the somewhat less sparkling intellect of William Shakespeare, a man who left not a single book in his will and spent his last years relentlessly pursuing matters pertaining to his tithes. Not alchemy, as Raleigh and the Wizard Earl had done, not witchcraft, a subject that evidently fascinated Marlowe and the author of Macbeth, but tithes and litigation, as though nothing in the world truly mattered except for money. How many zeros might balloon in mischievous vacuity behind a particular figure. This man, a zero in his own right, was perfect. Tom Walsingham arranged it, and from then on Marlowe, already posthumous, used the fellow's name, perhaps even his hand, but had no need of his spirit, having substituted his own instead. Thus did the dead speak through the living. And this would also explain the curiosity often remarked upon of what appears to be a considerable knowledge of continental Europe on the part of a man who never seems to have journeyed south of Bermondsey. It might also explain the kindly tone so often employed in the collected works when the word spy appears. For Marlowe had been one himself while he was at Cambridge. It was the state, after all, which had employed him to travel to Reims, there to impersonate a Catholic at a Jesuit college, to ensnare real Catholics and facilitate their imprisonment on their return to England. This might also explain the fascination with disguises that flows through the plays like a continuous and mighty river. And it explains the oddity of what I had so constantly noticed, that this man seems to know from practical and sinister experience something about murder and its accoutrement. Marlowe had killed at least one man, and others had undoubtedly attempted to kill him. A whole state waited to do so, should it ever be revealed to them that he was still alive somewhere and writing. And it finally explains that otherwise inexplicable peculiarity of language in As You Like It. When a man's words are misunderstood, it strikes a man more dead than a great reckoning in a little room. How can anyone be more dead? One is either dead or one isn't. Comparatives don't come into the matter at all. Unless, of course, one is universally thought to be dead, while in fact continuing to live and write under another's identity. The dead man's fingers are holding the pen that signs the living name. Banquo, the Marlowe figure in Macbeth, dies but does not stop acting. In fact, he is more potent in his presence after his death than before it. Now he really does terrify the king. And lastly, it explains the desolation of the tragedies, though explain here is surely not the right word. Some things can never be explained. For what could be more desolating than to live a life as someone else, in disguise, displaced hundreds of miles from your country and your lovers, or to be the greatest writer of your time, perhaps of any time, and for no one but you and a few secret confidants in another country to know it. This is the desolation of being no one with no real body. This is hell, to know you are not out of it. I wanted to read this passage from China, which is the last book that of mine that's just been published. I suddenly realised I've picked two passages of desolation, which I haven't thought about before. I'm sorry about that. I'm sure that Sheena will cheer you up in a minute. But, Digby, the main character of China, is old and slightly ill and extremely disgruntled with the world, and he spends most of his time, as a lot of old people do, thinking back to when he wasn't quite so old. And one of the things he thinks about a great deal is his troubled marriage to Vicky. Vicky finally is separated from him and in her final months goes to live back with her parents in Hastings, and this is Digby as he remembers those occasions. Towards the end, she had grown contemplative. He wasn't sure to what extent this was the drugs. He would travel down by train to see her every week. "Do you think I invited him in?" she had asked one day. She was lying on the bed, and Digby was staring out of the back window at the junk in her father's backyard, an old bathtub, a pile of tires, a long dead bicycle. "Who, Vicky?" "The one inside, the one that's killing me. I've invited a lot of others in, you know, a lot more than you ever knew about. Not just you and Jimmy. Do you think I invited him in?" Digby turned from the window and looked hard at her pale, wasted face. He had never seen flesh so white. "I don't know, Vicky. I think he would have come anyway. It's just that he acts as though he's been invited. He certainly makes himself at home. He never stops eating. Just like Theo when he was little. Munch, munch, munch. Now I know what it is to be truly loved. This one adores me. It'll never come out again into the sunshine, will it? Rather go down to the grave inside me. Shouldn't think either you or Theo would do that, now would you? Be honest, love. Not even Jimmy, probably. Time to go to sea again. When did we go last time? Our honeymoon. Water's the best thing. Goes along with things, but goes past them too. When it gets really cold, it's still. And when it gets really hot, it rises up for a while, but it always comes back down again. You can rely on it. Water's the best thing. Lets you see right through it. No secrets to hurt anybody with. No matter how hard you beat it, it doesn't change its shape or nature, does it? Always stays level with itself. Gets back together at the first opportunity. And it holds on to those inside it, the living and the dead. They all keep moving about in water." Digby often slipped into a kind of trance while she spoke. He had to rouse himself one day when he realized that she was making a request. Vicky was asking that she be buried at sea. Later, Digby had mentioned this wish to her father and brother. They had said nothing, but he had sensed in their silence some ancient Maltese prohibition. She had known when the pain arrived that this was the final pain. She'd had plenty of pain before, of one sort or another, much of it rooted in her addiction. But the constant consumption of hard liquor generates at least as much agony as it soothes, even while giving a shape to a drinker's day and some control over the drinker's life, mixing medicine with poison. But this was something different. This had about it an intensity of purpose and a disregard for her whimperings, which she had found startling in its purity. She had known right away that it had found its cave inside her, the one that it was destined for, and that none of the huntsmen of modern medicine would ever force it out again, for all their fire baitings and their sharpened, disinfected blades. It had come to stay, and she was the one who'd have to move on. And now the pain was quietly sucking at the morphine, a greedy baby at that breast inside, as the whiteness of the drug took all the technicolor misery out of everything. She was glad they'd made the drug white. As a girl, she'd had a glass paperweight that snowed whenever you shook it. How she had loved that snow, the way the little sky went crazy with it before settling on the village with its tiny street and bridge and river. Then all the colored roofs would be hushed to white. She thought of the kindness in a good dog's eyes. For some reason, she thought of that. The word fidelity loped on its four symmetric syllables slowly across her mind. Then something between her heart and her brain stopped happening, and she died.
Good evening. Can you hear me at the back? Yeah, I see you can. It's very nice to be here. My first time in Coventry or Warwick. I'm going to read from my novel Heligoland. It was inspired by the pearly nautilus shell, which is formed of chambers built by the marine creature which inhabits it. And I had the idea of a building based on the nautilus shell, which would provide human habitation. The novel opens in Scotland in the great winter of 1947, and then continues with its orphaned heroine Rowena's childhood at a boarding school in England, until she turns up at the Nautilus, applying for a job as resident housekeeper. Rowena is of Indian and Scottish ancestry. She's an autodidact, longing for knowledge and companionship, but without the education or the social skills to attain them. The bit I'm going to read is, it starts on an evening in the Nautilus, and I hope will be self-explanatory. Celeste Silberstein, fons et origo of the Nautilus, had dozed off over a book in bed, propped up by pillows. The light from her reading lamp gave her hair a bluish tone, and a succession of heavy earrings had almost indiscernibly elongated her lobes. Celeste's eyelids flickered behind her spectacles, and in her half-sleep, she was aware of her building's nocturnal sounds and the silence pounding like surf in the empty rooms. Two more vacancies, since the defection of Frau Stumpfenhose and Fräulein Bustenhalter, as Gus Krav insisted on calling them, to sheltered accommodation in Bromley, where by all accounts they were living the life of old Mother Riley. So much for their lame excuse that increasing infirmity made the Nautilus untenable. She'd caught them on daytime television, making an exhibition of themselves on a show hosted from the Glades shopping centre by some capering nebbish. Formerly perfectly acceptable potters, they'd materialised on the screen in Dirndl and Lederhosen, popping about in the hand-clapping dance from Hansel and Gretel, exposing not only feet, but knees and well-slapped thighs of clay. For this we pay our license fee. Celeste stirred at the reassuring crunch of Rowena's footsteps, the silence that suggested she had paused by the anchor, recognizing it as a symbol of a safe berth, and so, please God, would stay. She crossed her fingers on which the rings hung loosely. Celeste's back was curved, but like the Nautilus, she had a core of steel. This building, inspired by a spiral shell with a series of air-filled chambers, was the fulfillment of a dream. In collaboration with her late husband, Arkady, she had designed it on modernist and utopian principles, presided over its opening in 1936, and lived within at the center of a floating community of cosmopolitan refugees, dispossessed artists and intellectuals, for whom the anchor at its entrance became emblematic in wartime and exile. In some lights, the anodized carapace had a viridescent sheen. At other times, it gleamed like a pearl. The great shell housed, in addition to its residential chambers, a laundry, a kitchen, a communal dining room where guests were welcome, studios and workshops, a printing press, and the Nautilus bar, like a glass and steel aquarium with its ultramarine piano. Chambered Nautilus, a cephalopod Nautilus pompilius of the Pacific and Indian Oceans, having a partitioned shell lined with a pearly layer, also known as pearly Nautilus. A Nautilus, to Celeste's distress, was the name given to the world's first nuclear submarine. The surrounding beach had been transported piecemeal from Dungeness in lorry loads of shingle, with a section of breakwater, flotsam and jetsam, coastal plants, green fishing floats, and the anchor on its chain. Francis Campion had dug up a pair of slats, the slabs of wood that Dungeness people tie under their boots with tarred twine to facilitate walking on the deeply shelving shingle. He wore them still and called them the shoes of the fishermen. North London had its Isochron, South London its Nautilus. And although time had dealt more kindly with the letter, age was corroding its complex interior. And by the start of the new millennium, there were few visitors. The ultramarine piano in the Nautilus bar was dumb, and all the original residents, but Celeste and Francis Campion, were long gone. And ideas and ideologies were broken glass and crumpled paper. This bit concerns one of the other two residents in the Nautilus. Francis Campion is an old poet. Francis Campion had climbed obediently between the sheets for the late book, and at last he snuggled down to the radio's lullaby sailing by, unwinding his legs, which had twisted into a corkscrew. If he opened his fingers a little bit more, he could see Louis McNeice's hat on the door. Francis couldn't sleep until the BBC had tucked up its listeners with the shipping forecast and the national anthem. Even so, he was often woken at 2 by Lily Bolero to find himself in the throes of the World Service. He took a rather sardonic view of his dependence on dear old Ronald Binge's sailing by, so quintessentially Middlebrow and Middle England. But then, his happiest years were spent in Broadcasting House, commissioning and producing drama, talks and poetry programmes, hence the hat of his old colleague Louis McNeice, firewatching in Caversham Park in the war, monitoring enemy broadcasts, a stint or two as a sub-editor on The Listener. The 1950s had found him coating nuts and fondants with chocolate at the Payne Sweet Factory on Croydon Road, employment which had inspired his most anthologized poem, Poppets, a celebration of the eponymous confectionery and the interlocking plastic poppet beads worn by his female fellow workers. He could still hear the girls' and women's voices singing along to Workers' Playtime on the wireless. How sweet in retrospect were those light programme, chocolate-scented days when he'd cycled home to the Nautilus with assorted mist shapes rattling in his saddlebag. Nowadays, he listened mostly to music, since the old home service had become, by and large, radio bore, with its websites and fact sheets, churning out consumer anxiety and doom from every corner of the globe, spreading alarm and despondency, stranding him on a spit of land ever eroded by a Philistine sea, with his telescope trained on the past. Somewhere out there on the airwaves was a simple nostrum, a herb of grace which would have been balm to his hurt soul. But where was the listener to poetry, please, who would request a poem by Francis Campion? Increasingly, this survivor in a once polyglot sheltopia was aware of a creeping xenophobia that was turning him into a parochial old tortoise. He was glad Celeste couldn't read his mind. Celeste saw good in everybody and believed the most abysmal reprobates to be on the side of the angels. The covers of Francis's books faded to the colour of dusty tea and embossed with the Nautilus Press colophon, enclosed experimental verse and political satire, as well as lyrical and pastoral poems. But now that the world had gone beyond satire, he saw how his youthful absurdism was just a product of its era, a minute, odd-shaped piece in a jigsaw puzzle, and that his imagism and all his isms were regarded now, if at all, as merely period pieces. Each stage of his development had led not to some glorious late flowering and public recognition of his gift, but only to a stint on the committee of the society, which was widely referred to by its unofficial acronym, DAMS, taken from Wordsworth's observation that we poets in our youth begin in gladness, but thereof comes in the end despondency and madness. Next to his own stood the collected works, in Gaelic and English, of his old friend Magnus Scrabster, that scrawny island sheep whose long face Francis dearly would love to have seen again. After the war, Magnus has chosen the better part, rejecting the metropolis, his roots gripping ever tighter the granite beneath his native soil, piercing the stone and entwining the skeletons of animals and birds, the skulls of his forefathers. Francis envied Magnus, his sea, skies and rocks, the skirl of the skuas, the coronachs and pibrochs, the standing stones, the Gaelic that linked him to history, and even the wee wife Eugene, who had never cared much for Francis. Strangers and change. Francis mourned the parade of shops which had been part of his routine for years. The little community where he felt at home had vanished. The other day, he'd taken his spectacles to the optician's to have a lens which had fallen out replaced, and found himself, purblind, in a nail parlour. Familiar premises were boarded up or refurbished as inconvenience stores, where, to the succession of proprietors, Francis Campion was just another doddery geezer with a stream bag. Fortunately, though, the new housekeeper's young legs could take her further afield. Recently, Francis's general malaise had presented a fresh symptom. He was taunted by his own juvenilia. Suddenly, out of the ether, sprang an aborted verse, declaiming itself in a sarcastic voice, sibilant with adolescent thees and vows, making him wince and even groan aloud. A litter of alliteration, 100 waste paper baskets testifying against him. Several tubs of pills stood on his bedside table, but none contained a remedy for his anemia. Old men go mad at night, Tennessee Williams had observed, before his comparatively youthful demise from choking on the cap of a bottle of sleeping pills alone in a hotel room. You couldn't open these childproof containers with your teeth if you tried, although you might cut your fingers on the plastic seal. Quem Jupiter vult perdere, dementa prius. Of course, the gods had always had it in for poets. But in Francis' observation, the majority of old men go mad without divine intervention. He could write a book on mad old men running amok. The mad old men of London, in the crazy baseball caps of their dotage, and ladies' raincoats from charity shops. The roaring drunks who fall out of the bus at the wrong stop, shouting, "Thank you, driver," so that nobody will know they're drunk. Men without women going to seed. However, rather than frittering away such time he had left on misanthropic verses that would only mock him after he had gone, he must concentrate on his memoirs, Take Me Back to the Gaiety Hotel. But how laborious writing prose was, the slippery narrative thread that kept breaking, getting knotted up. Odd, though, how old women in general seem to retain a better grasp of things, even when widowed, not losing touch with soap and water, detergent, hairdressers, and all sartorial sense. Sailing by brought Francis consolation in the form of his own coffin, ship-shaped, of polished wood and gleaming brass, gliding along runners, disappearing through closing curtains, launched into eternity, with little coloured flags waving cheerily as if for a regatta. He thought that he would be able to put out to sea with equanimity if there was a band on the diminishing harbour front playing him out to sailing by. This bit concerns Rowena and takes place on the same evening. Rowena slept, dreaming of another establishment, another community. Chestnuts, the progressive boarding school founded during the war by Clifford and Wendy Waddilove, who had no children of their own. Wendy, whose lap made a comfortable hammock for a small child to rest in, and Rangy Clifford, with his scarlet waistcoat and brill-creamed hair that fell in a curtain over his face as he supervised the Wednesday pillow fight, or ran about the sports field, constantly interchanging pipe and referee's whistle. Chestnuts, many-chimneyed, red brick and tile-hung, condemned by the local community, stood at the end of an avenue of horse chestnuts, and both Conkers and Sweet Chestnuts studded the grounds which backed onto farmland. Its pupils were categorised by size into Sticky Buds, Candles and Conkers. To chestnuts it was that Rowena was dispatched when her aunt died, for who else would take her but Aunt Mysie's old university friend, Wendy Waddilove. And the last bit I'm going to read takes place when Rowena is cooking a meal for the first time in the Nautilus kitchen and wondering if she's doing the right thing. And she begins to think about her childhood and past. This kitchen, the glass sinks, all these surfaces and utensils, all hers. A song tries to rise in Rowena's throat, but what should she sing? Mrs. Diggins from the village, the cook at Chestnuts, would have killed for the knife block, the kitchen aid, the wearing blender, the orange juicer, the dual-lit toaster, the refrigerator and dishwasher. Mrs. Diggins managed somehow to get a brown skin on everything she cooked in her industrial-sized aluminium vats, custard, stew, mashed potato, and all her greens were grey. As midday approached, the smell of her dinner swirled around Rowena's empty stomach in a queasy blend of hunger and nausea. Mrs. Diggins first strode into her view, gaunt in a belted gabardine raincoat and short wellingtons, grasping in each hand a flapping hen by its legs upside down. She had the face of a cruel spoon, and although she cracked dissident children on the head with her ladle, the received wisdom was that Mrs. Diggins was a sport. She had her favourites, girls who clung to her arms like counterweights in the bitter wind as she lumbered across the icy grass in her zip-fronted snow boots to join in a skipping game, or link arms with the gang chanting, "Who wants to play cowboys and indie bums?" Or declare, "I am a girl guide, I am a girl guide dressed in blue. These are the actions I can do. Salute to the king, salute to the queen, salute to the German submarine." At German submarine, Mrs. Diggins thumbed her nose and sometimes her bottom. The little girl squealed. Even Trudel, who with Heinz and Ulrich was always served last at dinner. Sometimes there was no pudding left when it came to their turn. Trudel was not a girl guide. The Chestnuts children were barred from all the village's youth organisations. Mrs. Diggins clapped together for warmth her big fur paws, made from the skins of her own rabbits. Favoured pupils nuzzled these gloves with their cold noses and stroked them. To be out of favour with Mrs. Diggins was a state even the Waddilubs dreaded. Her umbrage was terrible. "I've got the ump," she would declare periodically, and then fear stalked the school. "Mrs. Diggins has got the ump. Sove keep her," Cliff would whisper and flee to hide in his study. Even though some had the full complement of parents, Mrs. Diggins bore tales of them poor little orphans to the village, a terrifying place where the local children threw stones at the Chestnuts' children, and the shopkeepers despised them as refugees and accused them of stealing. They watched them like hawks, so that it was difficult to get away with even a halfpenny chew. How the village had sneered at the Chestnut children's harvest festival gifts, ragged bunches of wildflowers and handmade baskets filled with ripe conkers that the vicar placed out of sight behind a pyramid of vegetable marrows. The Chestnut's ethos of self-expression was generally decried. It was bad enough that the pupils called their children by their Christian names, but when the Chestnut's handbell team took part in the all-village concert, not only were some of the band wearing lipstick, but the pretty one, in a pair of Mrs. Waddilove's cast-off peep-toe shoes, was obviously a boy. Mrs. Diggins wore a maroon-coloured lipstick, which stained her cigarettes and the rim of her special teacup. In summer, her stockings were rolled to the knee under her flowered overall. She had a brooch in the shape of a spider with a purple glass belly, which was odd because she was always splatting insects and stubbing out cheesy bugs with the toe of her boot. Bees and wasps drove her into a frenzy, and a mouse in a trap always put her into a good mood. More often than not, though, the children sprung the traps themselves and ate the cheese and bacon rinds. Mrs. Diggins had a daughter, Belinda, who was the same age as Rowena. Once, as a special treat for the Chestnuts children, Belinda Diggins came to show them her bridesmaid's dress and the charm bracelet and locket, which were a present from the bridegroom. She'd had her hair permed for the wedding. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marina.